This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, a group of Palestinian plaintiffs brought a lawsuit in federal court in America charging the Biden administration with complicity in Israel's genocidal assaults in Gaza and the West Bank.
They came as close as possible to winning this case, and they stirred up thousands of people giving a voice to the Palestinians.
We're also going to discuss the parallels between the growth of fascism in Hitler's Germany and in Trump's America.
We speak with attorney and historian Benjamin Kiter Hett on those parallels.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. Several months ago, various Palestinian human rights groups and individuals in Gaza and in the United States filed a lawsuit in a U.S. federal court against President Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, and Secretary of Defense Austin. Why? Well, for their failure to prevent and their complicity in the Israeli government's unfolding genocide against them, their families, and the 2.2 million Palestinians living in Gaza. They were represented by the attorneys at the famed Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. Well, a week ago, after a hearing that included testimony from 7 Palestinian plaintiffs and witnesses as to the scale of the destruction in Gaza and its impact on them and on their families, the court found that Israel's assault and siege on the Palestinian people in Gaza did, and I quote, plausibly, close quote, constitute genocide. And the court implored the Biden administration to examine its unflagging support, they called it, for Israel. Now, this constituted a profoundly important finding, but the court nevertheless dismissed the case on the grounds that it lacked jurisdiction over the administrative conduct of foreign affairs, and that is a longstanding rule in U.S. courts. What was the testimony of the plaintiffs in this case? What were the legal arguments put forth by their attorneys? And why did the court rule as it did? And what is the significance of the judge's finding that it was plausible that genocide was indeed taking place in Gaza, and its urging of the Biden administration to examine what the judge termed its unflagging support for Israel in its war on the Palestinian people? Well, to help us understand these questions and more, we're fortunate to have as our guest today one of the lead attorneys in the case, attorney Catherine Gallagher. Ms. Gallagher is a senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Her areas of legal expertise include matters of torture and war crimes and militarism. Among her many, many cases of great note is the case entitled Situation of Afghanistan at the International Criminal Court, and the case entitled Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests versus the Vatican. Now, prior to her work at the Center for Constitutional Rights, she worked at the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia.
Well, attorney,
and she is also now
Gallagher,
a visiting
very
professor
warm welcome
of law
to the law
at
and
the
Disorder
City University
Radio
of New York.
Thank you.
School
Thanks so much for
law.
Having me.
So, attorney Catherine
yeah,
Gallagher,
Catherine,
a very warm
tell us
welcome
about
to the Law and Disorder
and
Radio Show
case that we're discussing today. Who are they? And as you do so, also tell us about their courtroom testimony.
Sure. So the case I'm discussing again today is Defense for Children International Palestine against Joe Biden, President of the United States, as well as Secretary of State Blinken and Secretary of Defense Austin. And this case was brought back on November 13th by 2 Palestinian human rights organizations, Defense for Children International Palestine and Al-Haq, which is the oldest Palestinian human rights organization in Palestine, as well as 3 Palestinians who are currently in Gaza, including Dr. Omar El-Najjar, who was amazingly and powerfully able to testify from Gaza at the hearing we had on January 26th in Oakland. So he was able to testify. And then we have 5 Palestinian Americans who are all plaintiffs in this case. And each of the Palestinian Americans has family in Gaza and has close connections to Gaza. So they filed this case on their own behalf for the harms and the just horror that they've been enduring as they wait to hear the fate of their loved ones in Gaza and try and connect over these many, many months as their government, as the United States government, continues to send weapons to Israel, which, as Leila El-Haddad, one of the plaintiffs, said during her testimony on January 26th, that it's literally her family in Gaza is being killed with the weapons that her taxpayer dollars are going to buy. So it is five Palestinian Americans also as plaintiffs in this case, and we were able to hear them testify at a truly remarkable, historic, unprecedented hearing on January 26th in Oakland, California, in the Northern District of California court before Judge Jeffrey White, on why we were arguing this case should be able to proceed, a case that is challenging the failure of the Biden administration in the form of these three senior U.S. officials to wholly fail in their legal obligation to prevent the unfolding genocide in Gaza, and instead to be violating one of the most cardinal principles of international law, and that is that you should not be complicit in a genocide being the intent to destroy a people because of who they are, their nationality, their ethnicity, their racial identity, that Israel is actively at this moment, as the International Court of Justice ruled, and as ultimately in this hearing the judge found, there is a plausible case of genocide. So that's, I put a lot out there on the table, and we can follow up maybe on some of the specific threads.
Attorney Catherine Gallagher, your lawsuit was filed in a federal court, and the defendants that your Palestinian plaintiffs were suing were President Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, and Secretary of Defense Austin. From a factual as opposed to a legal point of view, what was it that you claimed each of these defendants did and are doing that caused them to be defendants in this case?
Thank you. From a factual standpoint, we sued these three senior U.S. officials in their official capacity. So we sued them as the head of the State Department, as the head of the Defense Department, and as the President of the United States, including in his capacity as, you know, commander-in-chief and overseer of the executive departments, including State Department and Defense Department. And what we set forth in our 85-page complaint, as well as, again, in our opposition to the government's motion to dismiss, is a dense factual accounting of the many ways that these three individuals and the departments and offices that they oversee have stood shoulder to shoulder with Israel from October 8th onwards, giving material support, moral encouragement, and in their own words, no red lines for the way that the U.S. support was being used and is being used at this moment against the Palestinian population in Gaza. So concretely, what that looks like is rushing weapons to Israel to be used again against the Palestinian population and to enforce a total siege against the population. So that is the situation that has sealed the Gaza Strip as 1.8 million people were quote unquote evacuated from the north to the south, and under continual and constant bombardment, a situation that has led to literally tens of thousands of deaths, including over 10,000 Palestinian children being killed, and that has led to the entirety of the Gaza Strip now on the brink of famine and starvation. That is with the total siege and the military bombardment, which has also taken out the vast majority of the healthcare system in Gaza and destroyed basic necessities like water lines and sewerage lines, while Israel is also cutting off access to electricity and food and fuel. So with that situation, the United States has sent munitions, whether it's shells to be used in the bombing, JDAMs would cause massive explosions or bunker-busting bombs. So rushing more weapons and continuing to do that, including bypassing any kind of congressional oversight, which is what we saw happen twice in December, by which point there were already warnings by the United Nations of the fact that Israel's intentions appear to be genocidal. So with the knowledge that there was a serious risk of genocide, if not an active genocide, the United States rushed weapons. Secretary of Defense Austin opened the stockpile in Israel for Israel's use, and there is an estimated $4.4 billion worth of weapons there so that Israel can just make use of those weapons. So it's rushing more for tanks, for shells, for massive bombs. Of course, the United States also provides much of the F-35s, which are used to drop bombs. The United States has also had drones over Gaza, so the United States is fully aware of the massive toll on Palestinian life and the destruction to Gaza that is going on. And that's on the military side. And then on the diplomatic side, we've seen these senior U.S. officials show up in Israel and offer any support that is needed, and until very recently, continuing to say with no red lines. And it's not so much that the United States has placed any conditions on the use of weapons, but it's trying to put some language around the side of, oh, we should be letting in some humanitarian aid, addressing the situation in Gaza as if it was a natural disaster, rather than the fact that what we are seeing right now, more than 4 months into this, is the implementation of a genocidal plan that has been backed politically by the United States, as it has vetoed ceasefire resolutions, as it has continued to refuse to follow the calls of the vast majority of the United States, of the population and of the world, for a permanent ceasefire and an end to the carnage. We've seen continued diplomatic support for Israel and refusal to stop the flow of weapons that are being used to kill Palestinian children today in Gaza.
Mm-hmm. My goodness. Well, you know, Catherine Gallagher, I have no doubt that you, more than I, are aware of the fact that the Center for Constitutional Rights is very often, thanks to Michael Ratner, I think, kind of pioneered this, a former founder and chair of CCR, this idea that if a case is important enough, if facts are big enough and important enough, that even though you know that there may be legal barriers to a successful outcome of the suit, you don't hesitate to bring it because it still can have a powerful impact, as I think we'll see this case is having. So in that regard, I suspect you and the other fine attorneys at CCR knew the plaintiffs had a huge legal barrier to overcome if they were going to secure any relief for their clients. And I'm referring, of course, to the issue of suing a U.S. administration over matters involving its conduct not on domestic affairs, but on foreign affairs. So explain why that is the case and what legal arguments you made in an attempt to overcome that defense by the Biden administration.
Sure. Just to kind of look back historically, and Michael, I am privileged that he was a mentor to me, and I am a deep believer that we have to confront in any ways that we can as lawyers abuses of power. And in that vein, CCR had brought a number of cases on behalf of victims of U.S. supported Israeli war crimes about 15 years ago, and we lost three cases at that time: the case Corey v. Caterpillar, the case against Avi Dichter for the dropping of a one-ton bomb on Gaza in a densely populated area, killing 15 civilians, and it's just remarkable that that El Daraj bombing in 2002 was something that was condemned globally, and you look now at how many one-ton bombs or more are being dropped almost daily on Gaza, with the world accepting it. But so we had the Dichter case, the Caterpillar case, and then a case around the bombing of a UN safe haven in Kana against Yalon. So those were three cases that we ended up losing, each of them, between 2005 and 2010, either on immunity grounds or political question grounds. And what we saw at that time was that the courts maybe weren't ready for cases like that, whether it was the corporate accountability side of things with Caterpillar or involving U.S. support for broad support for Israel's policies. Fast forward to where we are now, and it was very clear to us from those initial statements that were made by the Israeli defense minister, Israeli president, Israeli prime minister, that what was the intention of Israel in not only in rhetoric but in an action plan was genocidal. And so our calculus of whether or not to bring a case, that shifted here. And it shifted not only because of the severity of the harm and the need to raise that in a court, the fact that we were talking about genocide, which is universally recognized as really the most serious crime, a crime that the United States has recognized to be a violation of customary international law, and a crime that carries with it the duty to prevent, so that you should be taking action at the front end, not waiting until after tens of thousands of people or more have been killed, but that states have an obligation to do everything they can to save lives as soon as there is a serious risk. So we thought it was important to operationalize these legal principles against genocide, principles, again, that the United States helped enshrine in the Genocide Convention and has, as recently as last year, in the Ukraine v. Russia case at the International Court of Justice, affirmed. So we saw that there was clear law here. And then we've also seen, over the last 5 to 10 years, an evolution in the understanding of the political question doctrine. Already back at the time of Guantanamo, we had the Supreme Court make clear that a situation like war is not a, quote, blank check for the executive branch. But even more so in recent years, in the case that we're litigating, the El-Shamari case against Kaki, the Abu Ghraib torture case, we had a very clear decision out of the Fourth Circuit that when you're talking about violations of the law, like the prohibition against torture, that cannot be a political question. The political question doctrine has been about the judiciary not second-guessing policy decisions or making value determinations around optional foreign policy. When you're talking about genocide, that is a legal prohibition. It cannot be a policy choice. So similarly to what the Fourth Circuit found with regard to torture, and what the Supreme Court made clear in a case called Zivotofsky, that when there is a alleged violation of the Constitution or of a clear statute, especially a statute, again, it cannot be a policy choice. There is no review here because the political branches have already spoken. And just as genocide has been criminalized, that is a decision that the political branches took to criminalize genocide. So again, it can't be a policy decision. So we've seen that there are a number of legal decisions along these lines, including one related to genocide out of the D.C. Circuit. So we actually don't believe that this is a case that can't be won and that the courts can't review. We believe that there is a clear role for the courts when we are talking about a violation not only of a black letter law like the crime of genocide, but when we are talking about really what's viewed as the crime of crimes, one that is universally prohibited, it can't be that the President of the United States, that Joe Biden, decides that furthering a genocide is a policy choice. It's unlawful.
Now, Catherine, ultimately, the judge in the case did grant the U.S. government's motion to dismiss it, but the judge, in doing so, nevertheless, made some rather remarkable statements in the course of his ruling, Catherine. Tell us about these statements and what the judge said.
Sure. What was clear, just going back to the hearing that we had on January 26th, we had the legal argument that day about the political question, and then we also had at least 3 hours of testimony, again, from our plaintiffs. Ahmed Abu Ful spoke on behalf of El Haq, and he spoke about the loss of over 60 family members. As I mentioned, Leila El Haddad spoke about the loss of more than 80 members of her family on her mother's side and multiple members of her family on her father's side, and that these family members had been killed with U.S.-supplied weapons. Bassem El-Kara, whose family is a longtime Gaza family, spoke about having spent summers visiting his grandfather and the family home, which has been destroyed. Manad Al-Hirtala spoke about how one of his cousins, who was like a brother to him, had already lost 3 sons over the course of the Israeli assault on Gaza. And unfortunately, even since the hearing, his cousin Maher lost a 4th son. So we had these very, very powerful hours of testimony that Judge White seemed deeply engaged and very affected by what he was hearing as the plaintiffs spoke about not only the impact of the current assault, but spoke historically also about the Nakba and how that is very much in the minds of their families now, how so many of their families are in fact even refugees in Gaza because of the Nakba and ethnic cleansing that they face in other parts of historic Palestine. So at the conclusion of the hearing, Judge White said that this was really, in his 20-plus years on the bench, one of the most difficult factual, if not the most difficult factual and legal questions, and again, seemed very troubled, but did wonder about the role of the courts, particularly since it was the executive branch's decision to support Israel in this genocidal campaign. So his decision ultimately did dismiss the case on political question grounds, and we have just filed our notice of appeal, so we will be appealing the decision. But in so doing, he made a number of observations and conclusions, including laying out what the International Court of Justice had found the same day that we had the hearing, and that's that there is a plausible case of genocide. And then he himself came to that same conclusion, and he noted that there is, quote, undisputed evidence before his court that comports with the findings of the ICJ and indicates that the current treatment of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip by the Israeli military may plausibly constitute a genocide in violation of international law. That is a very, very powerful finding. And he continued on that the statements by various officials of the Israeli government, quote, indicate that the ongoing military siege in Gaza is intended to eradicate a whole people and therefore plausibly fall within the international prohibition against genocide. And he noted that it is every individual's obligation to confront the current siege in Gaza. And then in his closing, he pointed out the support that the U.S. government is giving and, quote, implores defendants to examine the results of their, quote, unflagging support of the military siege against the Palestinians in Gaza. So in essence, what he found is that there is an ongoing genocide in Gaza and that it is happening with U.S. support. And so we hope that already having these findings, both by a federal court in California and by the International Court of Justice, a court that the Biden administration itself has called on other states, including Russia, to support and acknowledge the weight of decisions, that these decisions would impact the course of action by both the executive branch and the congressional branch. Unfortunately, what we see is continued support going to Israel. We see the aid package or the military support package being discussed and debated in Congress, and it's not failing because people are concerned about a genocide. So we still need to see a fundamental shift by the Biden administration in line with what the judge said to really examine the results of their unflagging support for the military siege against Palestinians in Gaza.
Some of your last thoughts with the time we have left, where our listeners could learn more about the lawsuit and the work by the Center for Constitutional Rights, and as I say, your last thoughts on the suit we've been talking about.
Sure. I think just on the hearing that we had, two thoughts on that. One was that the plaintiffs and the attorneys were inside the court, and it was closed to the public. But outside the courthouse, there was just a massive rally, a massive support to the plaintiffs on a day that they each individually said was just so powerful, in a moment that they could bring their families, their truths, their histories into a official government building and have it heard. So for our plaintiffs, it was a powerful day. But to look outside and see streets of Oakland shut down and massive protests that had painted Biden as complicit in genocide and a huge banner hanging that said that same message. So inside and outside, we were united in our calls for the Biden administration to end their support for genocide. That is why our plaintiffs have filed this case. It is one that CCR is on all fronts working very, very hard to ensure that we have not only success in the courtroom on appeal, but that our message is heard by policymakers, by advocates and activists in the media, to try and do whatever we can to stop the flow of weapons, to stop the flow of diplomatic support for a genocide, and really to save lives in Gaza. So I do think that while it's a legal case, it is certainly part of a much larger movement, and I am hopeful we need to have some end to this horror as quickly as we can. And learn more about the case, I would suggest just go to our website, ccrjustice.org, and you will be able to find right there on the homepage information about the case.
Oh, my goodness. It's just great. My hat's off to you and to all the wonderful folks who have worked on this case at CCR. I hope our listeners will follow the good advice you've given to check it out on your wonderful website. Thank you so much for your work and for joining us today here on Law and Disorder, Catherine.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you. You take it easy, Catherine.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Some years ago, Michael Ratner, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and a co-founder of Law and Disorder Radio, interviewed our returning guest, attorney Benjamin Carter Hett. Hett is an historian, a professor at Hunter College, and a lawyer. He wrote a biography of the great German leftist attorney Hans Litten, who cross-examined Hitler, almost stopping him from coming to power by exposing Hitler's hypocrisy on the use of violence. As Michael wrote about Professor Hett's book, quote, "It brings to life the period preceding the takeover of Germany by Nazis. Litten's cross-examination of Hitler went to the heart of the Nazis' attempt to achieve power through violence." Trump has promised to do the same thing should he get elected. Professor Hett recently wrote about this in an opinion piece in the Los Angeles Times. In an interview with Fox News host Sean Hannity, Trump said he wanted to be a dictator, quote, on the first day of his new administration. It has been reported that Trump would invoke the Insurrection Act, which would allow him to deploy troops to crush protests, arrest dissidents, and shut down oppositional media. Trump is a fascist. He's not an advocate of the rule of law or of democracy. He boasts about using violence. In the divorce papers his first wife, Ivana Trump, filed against him, she alleged that he kept a book of Hitler's speeches at his bed table. Like Hitler, Trump appeals to his base and their desire for, quote, retribution. Trump said, "We pledge, quote, to you that we will root out communists and radicals and left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country." Hitler's racism was shown by his anti-Semitism, Trump's by his hatred of immigrants, who he says, echoing Hitler, quote, will poison American blood. Our guest, Benjamin Carter Hett, joins us. He is a former trial lawyer. He is now a professor of history at Hunter College and the author of several books, including Crossing Hitler, The Man Who Put the Nazis on the Witness Stand. Most recently, he has written an opinion piece in the Los Angeles Times titled, 2024 could be the year America fends off dictatorship or invites it in. Professor Hett, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be back with you.
Ben, American democracy is already greatly diminished. There's been a good deal of talk about how Trump, who almost certainly will be the Republican Party candidate for president, engages in talk speech similar to that of Hitler, as Hitler was fighting for power in Germany. You've written that Trump did not start out as a fully developed fascist, but that he's become one. Can you please talk about this?
Sure. So in my view, and I think there are probably... I know there are a lot of people who would disagree about this, but in my view at least, I think there are two things that are important about Trump. One is that he's quite, to put it bluntly, he's just jaw-droppingly stupid. He has very little ability to take information on board. The second thing is he has no knowledge to start with. So he has no knowledge, he's unable to acquire knowledge, and so I think he has pretty much literally zero understanding of political ideas and political ideology. And I really don't think he's consciously a fascist or anything like that. What I do think is that he has emotional, psychological problems, basically, that have impelled him sort of instinctively to take positions which are, in effect and in content, fascist. And so I think that's what we're seeing play out a little bit. His incredible insecurity, making him unable to accept any kind of rejection, is, I think, behind his rejection of the 2020 election results, and lots of things flow from that. His desire for revenge, he keeps talking about retribution, and then added to this, I think he has a genuine kind of gut-level racism, which is coming out more and more when he says things like, immigrants are poisoning the blood of our country, which is very straight out fascist, racist articulation. I don't think he sort of knows that consciously. I think it's kind of a gut thing. So I see him as this kind of instinctive gut fascist, if you will. And I think his political good fortune is that a bunch of resentment that he feels and can do nothing other than articulate, because I think he has no discipline to control the message. I think he has no calculation about what he says. Just what he sort of spontaneously lets out resonates with about a third of the electorate who happen to feel the same resentments and come in many ways from sort of the same place emotionally. And I think that explains, in my view at least, that explains the hold that he has gotten on a lot of the Republican base. And it explains why a lot of more rational Republicans have been unable to dislodge him from that control of the Republican base. But it's also why no other Republican has been able to replicate the formula, it seems. No one else, no matter how repugnant they are, seems to be able to acquire that same kind of hold of the base. Trump just has this kind of, almost Vulcan mind meld, I think, with a substantial chunk of Republican voters.
In this regard, you've also written about the fact that many Americans seem to want that kind of dictatorial governance that a Trump presidency would promise. Indeed, a recent mayor's poll, I think of it yesterday or the day before, just showed that that's become that issue of whether we're going to remain a democracy or not has become a number one issue among American voters. But nevertheless, with respect to this question of a dictatorship, many Americans seem to prefer that as well. What percentage of Americans and why? And you point out that Hitler and the Nazis in Germany, for that matter, got 44% of the German people's vote. So Hitler came to power legally, didn't he? In this regard, what are you afraid of here with Trump? For example, are you afraid that if elected, Trump would, as promised, invoke the Insurrection Act on his first day in office? Talk to us about this.
Yeah, okay, so there's a lot of things there. So the constituency in the American electorate for dictatorship, I mean, I don't know if I have the knowledge to say very precisely, but it seems to me roughly coterminous with Trump's base, which would be around a third of the total electorate and maybe two-thirds or so of the Republican electorate. And, you know, from things I've read or for things I've heard on the radio or seen on TV and whatnot from people who are experts on specific areas of this, it seems to me that there is a broad current of feeling among a lot of people in the United States, I think particularly white people, particularly evangelicals, who feel that the country has come to such a pass that, in a sense, it is moving so far away from anything that they can identify with or feel works for them or that they can relate to, that the only solution now is a drastic one. The only way to basically stop pluralist, multiracial democracy is with an authoritarian solution that can enforce, basically, a kind of white nationalist, Christian, anti-democratic ascendancy. So I think if there is much coherent ideology underpinning Trump, it's probably that. I mean, I think that that's the thing that for some people who are kind of on Trump's side, this is somewhat thought through, this is somewhat consciously thought through and articulated as an ideology. And so it has a resonance with, you know, substantial bodies of conservative voters, particularly in rural, southern, and largely white areas. This is in some ways quite similar to Germany in the 1930s, in the sense that I think a core element here, a core unifying element, is a feeling of humiliation. And I've always said, I've written this a few times, in my view, humiliation is the most dangerous political emotion, because if you feel that I have humiliated you, that will probably provoke you into a reaction which won't have much limit. I mean, I think that humiliation and the desire for revenge from humiliation is such a powerful thing that that's where we tend to see, in almost all cases, I think, extremist politics gets born out of that. A lot of Germans in the 1930s felt that. A lot of Germans felt that they had been humiliated by foreign powers, they had been humiliated in part by their own government, or they'd been humiliated by other sections of the German population, or all of the above. And that gave wings to the Nazis and explained a lot of their electoral constituency, which in fully free elections netted them about a third of the electorate. When they got 43%, which they did once, in an only semi-free election in March of 1933, but that election was already only semi-free, and that was their best even semi-free electoral performance. In fully free elections, about a third of the electorate was the best they could do, driven by that, I think, primarily the element of humiliation. Now, in terms of what I'm afraid of for the United States, you know, I would really rather Trump didn't win, because I do think, you know, I do think he will feel that he has no limitations on what he could try to do as president, and I am quite sure that a second Trump administration would not contain some of the fairly reasonable figures who were in, at least in part, in the first Trump administration. There would not be, so to speak, any adults in the room. He would have nuts characters like General Flynn occupying key positions, and there would be no internal check. I often think of a quote, a guy who was very important in the early days of the Nazi regime was a man named Rudolf Diels, who was the first chief of the Gestapo, the secret police. And Diels managed to survive the war. And in the 50s, he positioned himself as someone who had been anti-Nazi, and he wrote once in the 1950s that he was worried that the Nazis were going to come back in Germany, and he wrote, "And when they come back, they won't start again in 1933, they'll start again at 1945. In other words, they'll start again at the most extreme place they have got to." And I think that will happen with Trump. if he comes back, he won't start again at 2017. He'll start again, you know, kind of around January 6, 2021. He'll start again with that. So I would not be surprised if he tries to invoke the Insurrection Act to stop protesters. I would not be surprised that almost anything he might do, trying to use government powers to shut down media outlets to criticize him, certainly, he said as much, certainly using the justice system to go after individual people that he thinks are enemies of him. I think you can basically count on that happening. It will be a severe, unprecedented attack on the rule of law in America, on freedom, on democracy, on basically anything that we might ever have thought constitutes the American political identity. That said, and this is something we can pursue a lot, and I'll stop with this. I don't see that quite as darkly as some people, because I think there would be resistance, not from Republicans, but from outside Republican Party and lawmaking circles. I think there would be a lot of resistance from Americans, and I think America has a lot of antidotes against fascism. So I think Trump would try to be a dictator, and he would try to do terrible things. I suspect he would mostly fail, probably not completely fail, but I think he would mostly fail. So that's, I guess that's my take on where it comes from and what I'm afraid of might happen.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my former law partner and co-host, Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with Benjamin Carter Hett, who's a former trial lawyer and now a history professor. Ben, Hitler based much of his appeal on resentment, the feeling of resentment that the German people felt after they were defeated in World War I and by the onerous treaty the Allies imposed on Germany after the war. Is there anything like that here in America that echoes the Germans' people resentment? Trump supporters in America today say that they feel that, and that is an indication of his popularity. Can you talk about that, please?
Yeah, you know, I think that's one of the areas in which there is actually a quite close and in many ways quite alarming parallel between Germany then and America now. I think one side of this has to do with what Trump and his people always invoke as globalism, which is an interesting word which has all kinds of resonances, some of them quite consciously sort of coded anti-Semitism. But the whole idea that there's a world out there that's malevolently hostile to America and needs to be resisted by asserting, as Trump puts it, America first. You know, this playing to a sense of American resentment of other powers' economic impact on the United States, the effects of trade, the effects of outsourcing of jobs, all this whole sort of package of things that particularly Trumpist politicians are invoking when they invoke globalism, with a little shot of anti-Semitism, to be sure. How often do they talk with George Soros or somebody like that? This tracks quite closely on one of the, or probably the most successful Nazi message when they had to win free elections, which was a very similar appeal to nationalism as a defense against globalization, which the Nazis also always rhetorically coded as Jewish. In researching this, I've sometimes found some quite striking things. The Nazis' main propagandist, Joseph Goebbels, who edited a newspaper, wrote in his newspaper in 1932, quoting here, do we want to build a wall around Germany? Yes, we want to build a wall. It's kind of striking that even that very same imagery is being used to express, you know, a nationalist, they might have said Germany first, response to globalization. So I think that's part of it. And then the other part, I think, is internal. It's kind of what I was saying before. One of the many interesting things about Germany in the early 30s is that it had a kind of red state, blue state division that in some ways tracks quite closely onto American experience, and especially in terms of Berlin versus the rest of the country. Because, you know, Berlin, you know, this is something everybody knows, you know, if you've watched Babylon Berlin or whatever, you know, I mean, Berlin was really ground zero of all kinds of aspects of modernization of art, you know, music, a really large and quite successful gay rights movement, women's movement, you know, sort of sexual liberation of all kinds. And certainly Berlin has throughout its history always been politically liberal and left in what has often been a generally conservative country. So there was this feeling among a lot of Germans, especially right-wing Germans, that Berlin is like fundamentally alien to Germany, but that's where the power is, and we're being run from Berlin, And all the Berliners do is look down their nose at everybody outside of Berlin, and they think we're inferior. They think we're just peasants with pitchforks. You know, so there's a lot of hatred of Berlin and what it kind of symbolizes. And what it kind of symbolizes is everything liberal, modern, you know, socially progressive. And, of course, we see that same kind of dynamic here, and it comes out in so many ways. Like, look at, you know, what's happening with governors of Florida sending, you know, migrants to, you know, what they like to call sanctuary cities in the north, which are always liberal-run cities, New York, Chicago, whatever. I mean, this is just one little straw in the wind of this whole kind of resentment of progressive, liberal, urbanized spaces by the spaces outside of those spaces, which are the spaces that vote for Trump, you know. So I think, you know, and Trump never wins big cities. That kind of political dynamic, I think, is quite strikingly similar from the German experience of back then to the American experience now.
I wonder, Benjamin, let's take one of the parts of the question you just answered and see if we can elaborate on it a bit, because it does seem rather central. And you point out the similarities around nationalism and racism, what have you. Talk a bit about what those similarities are between Hitler's appeal to German nationalism and racism and Trump's appeal to racism and, well, white American nationalism.
Both Hitler and Trump made rhetorical appeals to nationalism, which at first blush sound like they're being kind of inclusive, but in fact are quite exclusive of definite designated parts of the country. So, you know, the Nazis made a big deal out of being positioning themselves as being socially egalitarian and saying they want to break down class boundaries, they want to break down, you know, religious group boundaries, at least between Catholics and Protestants. They want to break down sort of geographic rivalries within Germany and create a one German identity. They want the country to be unified, you know, all Germans to be equal, all Germans to be one. But then, of course, that comes with a bunch of footnotes, and they never really articulate the footnotes, but they're there. You know, the footnotes are, does not apply if you're Jewish, does not apply if you're a communist, does not apply if you are gay, does not apply if you suffer from a disability, you know, does not apply if you are Sinti or Roma. Other than that, all Germans are one, and all Germans should be united. And it's a bit the same with Trump. If you think about his inaugural address in 2017, where he says, you know, he's fighting for the forgotten man, and he sort of often has this rhetoric that he's going to bring back the greatness of America and bring back a unity. But of course, then rhetorically, he doesn't even try sometimes to speak to substantial groups of the country which he has identified as enemies. So it's a nationalism which is actually highly exclusive. And a lot of people have pointed out that when Trump speaks, he codes things in such a way to really be speaking to white evangelicals, and they pick up the message. So he's really kind of speaking, nowadays especially, I think, first and foremost to white evangelicals with a rhetoric of nationalism that is meant to exclude, like, basically, you know, more than half of the country, you know, people of color, people with people who are immigrants or children of immigrants, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Ben, Hitler pretended to respect the rule of law, but he used violence. And Trump has also proclaimed that he supports the rule of law, but he also talks about using violence. He talks about he wants to root out the vermin and the communists and the socialists and so on. Talk to us about what was done to the rule of law in Nazi Germany and how the rule of law is being eroded today here in the USA.
Yeah, you know, Hitler played a quite complicated game with the rule of law, especially rhetorically. In some ways, Trump is simpler, but I'll get to that in a sec. When Hitler was not in power, when he was campaigning to be in power, he realized that to win free elections, he had to rhetorically present himself as someone who would follow the law, respect the Constitution. So he always said that over and over again in speeches, even in court testimony. He would insist that the Nazi Party was constitutional, they would follow the law. But then there were sort of two caveats to this. One caveat is that his party had its own paramilitary force, you know, famously known as the Brown Shirts, also known as the Stormtroopers, whose job before the Nazis were in power was to find the actually similar paramilitary activists of other political parties, especially the communists, find them and get into fights with them. So the German politics in those days was actually a kind of gang warfare between the paramilitary gangs of thugs of different parties. And every party kind of had its gang of thugs. Even the relatively moderate Social Democrats had their political gangs that were out there fighting with the Nazi thugs and the communist thugs and the thugs of the kind of mainstream right nationalist party and so on and so on. So Hitler's always doing this difficult dance, and he had to speak differently to different parts of his constituency. To win elections, especially to get middle-class voters, he had to say, you know, legal, 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 constitution, constitution. Then he has to turn to his stormtroopers and basically kind of say, I'm just kidding, let's use violence to overturn the system. And he did really use both. I mean, his party won elections, and he was then appointed chancellor by the president in a theoretically fully constitutional way. But then they used violence to consolidate their power. Once they were in power, the stormtroopers were out, you know, en masse, rounding up political opponents, rounding up communists and liberals and socialists and other kinds of people like that who were Nazi opponents, and imprisoning them in completely unofficial prisons and torturing them and beating them and killing them. So it's this kind of tricky game with legality. All the while, Hitler liked to pose publicly as a champion of law, while meanwhile, right from the beginning, his people are engaged in lawlessness. Trump is similar a bit. If anything, Trump is less rhetorically careful than Hitler. And I put this down to basically that he's much less intelligent and much less calculating. Hitler was both of those things, which we don't always like to, I think, acknowledge, but it was true. Hitler wouldn't have got where he got if he wasn't cunning and he wasn't calculating. Trump is, I think, extraordinarily unable to engage in political calculus and discipline what he says. So stuff comes out. You know, when he says, you know, I'll be a dictator on day one and I'll be your retribution and all the sort of threats that he issues, it's because he can't control himself. He's not capable of the kind of tricky rhetorical performance that Hitler pulled off. But that said, I think they would end up in about the same place. I think a President Trump in 2025 would be doing a lot of what Hitler was doing. He would be pursuing his enemies, perhaps often with violence, or he would have surrogates, like maybe Proud Boys or somebody like that, pursuing his enemies with violence. He would be using the judicial system to pursue enemies, of course, very much as the Nazis did. I think all of that would be much the same. While perhaps at some rhetorical level, Trump would say he's just, you know, restoring the Constitution to what it should be or something like that. I would not be surprised to see, you know, that kind of performance happening in a renewed Trump administration.
In light of what you've just said, the fact that Trump is so much more open, flagrantly open about what he would do and the rather outrageous things he would do, he's not subtle at all. Does that give you more concern that he still enjoys as much support as he does then?
It gives me massive concern. We're at a place I honestly never dreamed we'd be in America, that he could have said and done all the things that he has said and done and still have the support that he does, still be an entirely viable candidate for president. I think this is an experience that none of us have had in our lifetimes, and for any kind of parallel, you'd have to reach back, you know, a century or more. You know, I thought, like a lot of people probably, I thought after January 6th, I thought, okay, well, that's it. You know, he's finally done. Even the Republicans won't take this. But, of course, they have. So, honestly, I have no idea what else he could possibly do to antagonize that seemingly immovable third of the electorate that stays with him.
Trump is on trial, criminal trial, in Georgia and in D.C. and in Florida. What do you think is going to happen there? And are those trials going to get concluded before November of this year when the election takes place?
As to whether those trials are going to conclude before November, probably your guess is as good as mine, or actually probably your guess is better than mine. What it looks like right now is that maybe one or two or even more of them might be happening in the fall, right as the campaign is underway, and that'll be interesting. Whether they'll conclude, I suspect, because I'm sure whatever happens, there would be appeals. How that process works out, I think we'll only really see if Trump loses, in which case those cases will continue. Of course, if Trump wins, at least the federal cases will be over. But the Georgia case may keep going, depending on all the variables there. You know, I think the other interesting thing is what effect it has. And I think there's a real question as to how much you can achieve a political goals with judicial processes. It seems to me, on evidence available so far, that the prosecutions of Trump have probably had no effect on moving the dial one way or another on his popularity, other than, I think, to solidify his hold on his own base, which seems to happen. There doesn't seem to have been any reduction in his popularity from all these charges. We keep seeing polls saying that even some of his core voters would think again if he were actually convicted. It's difficult for me to believe, after all that we've seen Trump do, which has had no impact whatsoever on his base, it's difficult for me to believe that something that they might easily construe as a frame-up by the deep state would suddenly change their mind. I think the only thing we can do is beat him at the ballot box.
Unfortunately, Ben, we've come to the end of our allotted time. We're going to have to say goodbye. But before we do that, can you tell our listeners how people can follow your work?
Sure. You can find information about me at my website, which is BenjaminCarterHet.com. I've written 6 books, which are all available on Amazon and other similar outlets. My books are generally all about German history, the Nazis, the run-up to World War II, and the rule of law and the role of law in German history.
Thank you again. Let me add my thanks and appreciation to a very clear and convincing and understandable presentation. We thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to talk to you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.